0350, United States of America versus Chapman Rogers Mays. You may proceed with your argument, Mr. Couture.
Hey, please the court, Mr. Magliolo. My name is John Couture. I represent Mr. Mays today. The government appears to have all but conceded in this case that Mr. Mays' misappropriation of monies from his daughter's trust account as custodian of that account did not create a duty for him to list those monies as his property on his bankruptcy. For he is not guilty of the offense to which he pled guilty. The government, it appears to me, focuses most of its arguments on why this court shouldn't reverse under plain error review, particularly the third and fourth prongs, doesn't affect the serious or the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of the judicial proceedings. The government, as I see it, basically makes four arguments to that end. Number one, Mr. Mays stole money from his daughter and he needs to be punished. Number two, Mr. Mays wanted to plead guilty. That suggests that this was possibly an Alford plea, which would not require Mr. Mays to admit the elements of the offense. The third reason, that even if his conduct didn't violate Title 18 USC Section 152 sub 3, it did violate Section 152 sub 9. And the fourth reason the government appears to advance is that if this court were to vacate Mr. Mays' conviction, he could be jumping out of the frying pan into the fire, meaning he could be facing more serious charges. I'd like to address those four arguments. First of all, Mr. Mays stole money from his daughter and needs to be punished. Well, punished by whom? Not every wrong can be righted in federal court. Theft is generally a matter reserved to the police powers of the state. And for all the reasons I've set forth in both briefs, Title 18, 152 sub 3 just simply doesn't reach the conduct that the government has alleged as a factual basis. Well, okay, so does this error affect the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings? This is a quote from United States v. Olano, 507 U.S. 725. The Court of Appeals should no doubt correct a plain forfeited error that causes the conviction or sentencing of an actually innocent defendant. Again, I'm not suggesting that Mr. Mays is innocent, maybe in a theological sense, but I'm suggesting he's certainly innocent of this discharge. This is from United States v. Briggs, 939 F. 2nd 222. Simply put, to convict someone of a crime on the basis of conduct that does not constitute the crime offends the basic notions of justice and fair play embodied in the Constitution. So we think that this is grounds. It is plain error. Second reason, Mr. Mays wanted to plead guilty. Again, this suggests the possibility of an Alford plea. In 1970 in North Carolina versus Alford, 400 U.S. Section 20 or U.S. 25, Supreme Court basically said it's okay for a defendant to enter a guilty plea and yet deny the elements of the offense because he doesn't want to roll the dice and go to trial. They said you could do that.
But there are three things. An Alford plea. The Justice Department manual has frowned on those for years. And
okay,
so
all right. Well, I'll pass
maybe
that.
That's helpful to you. I mean, I don't know. But
okay. Well, I won't. I won't go any further on that. Why it's not an Alford plea.
I don't think Magliolo is going to say it's an Alford plea. If he says it's an Alford plea, then we'll come back on rebuttal. But I can't imagine he's going to say that.
Okay, well then I won't waste your time with arguing for why it's not. The third argument the government basically makes is that if his conduct didn't violate Section 152.3, it did violate Section 152 sub 9, and I've addressed that to the best of my ability in pages 3 and 4 of my reply brief, and I won't repeat it here. The fourth argument the government makes, and the government doesn't say this in so many words, it's more innuendo on page 10 of the government's brief, but the government seems to suggest that Mr. Mays' conviction were vacated, he could be facing more serious charges down the road based
on what— I'm sure you've explained that to him and you're his counsel and he knows what he's doing. Isn't that right?
That's all right. And the government, the counsel, appellate counsel, contacted me, Mr. Portugal, I probably mispronounced his name, after I filed the principal brief. He told me about the negotiations. He sent me documents suggesting, among other things, that Mr. Mays could have been charged with wire fraud and concealment money laundering, both of which carry a higher statutory maximum than this offense. Communicated all that to Mr. Mays, and I told him, because he asked me to, my opinion as to the viability of those other charges. And his exact words to me in a letter to me were that, knowing what I now know based on the law, I would not have agreed to plead guilty to something I did not do. The last comment I feel like I need to make, I think I made a mistake in my relief request. As to this first issue, I asked that this court dismiss the conviction. I'm not sure that this court has the authority to do that under these circumstances, and I believe the proper request would have been that this court order that the conviction be vacated. Unless there are questions, I yield back the rest of my time.
Okay.
One quick one, if you don't mind. 152 sub 3. Do we read that as requiring only a false statement generally, or a false statement about the bankruptcy estate specifically?
Well, I attempted to address that in my reply brief, or I think I did anyway. That appears to be one of the government's arguments, that any false statement can come under 152 sub 3. My argument basically is it has to be a false statement in connection with his bankruptcy filings, not just the fact that he may have told a lie somewhere, sometime to somebody.
If hypothetically we disagree with you, and if we read 152.3 as requiring only a false statement, do you lose?
No, because the bankruptcy, well, what he put on there, well, if you want to rewrite the bankruptcy code, well, that's probably not right. The bankruptcy code does not require him to list the monies that the government says constituted a false statement. That's the way I read it. If he has no duty to do it, then he hasn't lied by failing to list them. So I wouldn't call it a false statement under any circumstance.
So it's not his money, so he doesn't need to list it on the bankruptcy schedule, is your position?
It's not his money in any way, even though...
Even if he's taken it.
Right. And let me say this, for what it's worth. An ad litem was appointed in the bankruptcy proceedings. A house that was co-owned by Mr. Mays and his wife, they were in the middle of divorce proceedings, was sold, a real estate agent was appointed, and Mr. Mays tells me that sold for $500,000. So not that exonerates him, but to a certain extent, the daughter, who obviously has money taken from her, has recovered a portion of what was taken.
With regard to the restitution issue, that quite a bit of time was spent on that this isn't proper restitution, you know, under Sharma and others, because it's not related to the, it's not on the claim. And I haven't heard from you on that today.
Well, I think this was going to probably revolve around how this court resolves the second issue, and that's whether or not the plea bargain can be complied with. If the plea bargain can't be complied with, then there is no restitution. The restitution was part of the plea bargain. If the plea bargain can't be complied with, then my argument is that Mr. Mays doesn't have a duty under the law to pay restitution. So to me, it revolves on how this court resolves the second issue, and that is, you know, is the plea bargain still in effect or is it not?
So is it your position that if he agreed to pay the restitution, even though he legally wasn't required to do so, arguendo, that you can't, if the plea bargain stands, then you can't win on restitution because he agreed? Is that, are you conceding that?
No, I'm not. I'm scared to concede anything. But I will say, Mr. The government said no. What we agreed to, my argument basically was, look, if you're gonna sell this stuff and you're gonna apply it to the restitution, you have to do it at a point in time when the court actually has authority to take the matter up. The government says, well, we didn't limit ourselves. Mr. Magliolo may disagree with me. My understanding is the government's position is we didn't limit ourselves to that in the plea agreement. We left ourselves the possibility that this could happen somewhere down the line.
Right. Now, well, I'm not talking about whether the airplane gets credited. I'm talking about whether or not this restitution award is legally viable because it's not based upon restitution on the pleaded crime. And so it's a technical problem under Sharma. And then I guess I'll ask Mr. Magliolo about that, if it's cured or not by the fact that he pleaded.
I just, my understanding is that you can pretty much agree to about anything in a plea bargain. And if you do, and that's part of the plea bargain, then you can't go back and say, well, it was illegal. I think you can agree to things like this where absent a plea bargain, it couldn't hold up. I could be wrong about that.
Does he get the credit at some point for the plane and the other stuff to take off? I know he didn't get it in the judgment, but it's being credited against his debt, isn't it?
Well, I don't see how. I think the short answer to that, in my opinion, is no. It's supposed to be, but at this point in time, it hasn't been.
Well, I know, but when they start doing the restitution schedule, they're going to do accounting on that, aren't they? Okay,
you're assuming there's going to be one. If there is, you're right, okay. I think.
Did someone else have a question?
Nope.
Mr. Kuchera, did you want to tell us anything else about the case?
Yeah.
Okay, well, you've saved time for rebuttal, sir. Thank you. Mr. Magliolo?
Thank you, Judge Elrod, and may it please the court, Joe Magliolo for the United States. I'd like to start by addressing Mr. Kuchera's claims about the bankruptcy fraud argument, because I think he has simply misstated both what he has accomplished in his brief and argument and what the government purportedly conceded, because we certainly have not conceded that he came anywhere close to establishing plain error prongs one or two. And just as an initial matter, and I think to touch on what Judge Willett asked about with respect to Section 152.3, and this is a point we made in our brief, a person can and often will violate Section 152.3 by lying essentially in any material and fraudulent fashion with respect to anything that occurs in a bankruptcy case. It does not necessarily have to be limited by what is going to be in the bankruptcy estate. At the outset of the bankruptcy process, I don't believe the bankruptcy estate is determined or even determinable. And I know this because a person is going to list property on bankruptcy schedules that may not ultimately become part of the bankruptcy estate. And I know this among other reasons because Mr. Mays listed property on his very own bankruptcy schedules. And you can see this at Record Excerpt Tab 5. He listed property in his own bankruptcy schedules, which he did not intend to become part of the bankruptcy estate. In Schedule A, for example, he listed a home for disclosure purposes in which the value of his interest was unknown. And by the same token, in Schedule B, Mr. Mays listed a number of pieces of personal property, which he then said were exempt from the bankruptcy estate. And I say all this to say that there is going to almost necessarily in every case be situations where people are meant to list property that will not ultimately become part of the bankruptcy estate, which I believe vitiates Mr. Kuchera's claim that a person is unable to lie about Section 152.3 unless they, if they do not list property, which will not ultimately become part of the bankruptcy estate.
But you agree that he did not have a duty to list this, right?
I don't agree, Your Honor. I don't think
he had a duty to list this, even though it was not his property. He had a duty up front to list this.
I do, Your Honor. A person is meant to list a broader group of property on a Schedule B than what necessarily may end up in the bankruptcy estate.
But what provision said he had to list this? I understand if he's stealing it and he's really in his possession, then it's maybe his property and that complicates it. But if it were a pristine account for this custodial account, why would he have to list this?
Well, Your Honor, I think, for example, on Schedule B, it asks for a person, a debtor, to list any manner of property in which they have an interest. I mean, this court in United States
doesn't have an interest.
He doesn't have a
held for someone else, and he's not supposed to have an interest in it. Well, it's complicated because he did take an interest.
I certainly agree with that, Your Honor. I mean, he may not have a legal, interest insofar as he obtained the property legally, but he has not established, I think, under clear or obvious law that he was not required to list this in his bankruptcy schedule.
A regular person wouldn't have, it wasn't stealing it, wouldn't have to put this in their bankruptcy thing.
I don't actually know that that's the case, Your Honor. I think a person is meant to list in their bankruptcy Schedule B property to which they have legal title. Trustees have legal title to property. That doesn't mean it becomes part of the estate if a person is acting in a good faith fashion. And Mr. May simply has not, in his brief or in this argument, established by clear or obvious law that a person who is stealing property is exempt from listing that property in.
Well, I'm putting to side with the stealing. I'm asking whether or not he had a fortiori duty to list this property.
I believe I'm no expert on this, and I don't think he's established under plain error that he, had no obligation to do so. But I believe a person who is a trustee does have a legal title to the property. Schedule B, for example, a blank Schedule B at this time, Your Honor, it called for a person to list property in which they had, that they were holding, for example, for a minor. And then going forward, you can then say under Schedule C, well, I claim that this property is exempt. And his failure to do so mattered a great deal in this case, because had he been honest about the property in which he had a legal title, property that he was holding for somebody else, it would have given notice to somebody like his daughter, who apparently had an ad litem, people with an interest in this case, that there was this property out there that Mr. Mays was holding that they could have had access to. It also matters a great deal because his daughter was left off the schedule of creditors. And so I concede that in a normal case, stolen property would almost certainly not be available to a big group of creditors from whom the property was not stolen. But that's not the case here. There is a big unsecured creditor left off of the schedules to whom that information would have been absolutely relevant. And that's why I think Mr. May was obligated to list this property under Schedule B to give notice to the world, to give notice to the potential creditors, of whom his daughter was a very, very significant one.
Are you saying the Schedule B says holding for a minor?
The version that is in the record excerpts does not say it, Your Honor, but I looked at a blank copy of the Schedule B promulgated by the bankruptcy courts at this time that was available, and it did say that a person was meant to list property that person was holding on behalf of a minor.
Where did you get that?
From the bankruptcy court website, Your Honor.
Which bankruptcy court website?
The United States bankruptcy courts. I think there is a...
Which one? I mean, like you're saying some national group, or are you saying a particular court?
It is a .gov courts website that provided blank forms to potential debtors, one of which is a Schedule B, just like Mr. Mays filled out, and it obligated a person to list this property. But I think also we should go back.
I'm guessing that form did not in turn cite any authority for that. And what is the authority for the notion that funds that Mays appropriated from custodial accounts ought to be listed as personal property on Schedule B?
Well, Your Honor, I can't say that there is any, but I think that cuts against Mr. Mays, not in his favor, because it's his obligation to demonstrate under clear or obvious law that the stolen money could be kept off of Schedule B. And that is not a showing that he's made, which is fatal to his claim on plain error review.
What about authority for listing the custodial accounts on the bankruptcy schedules, regardless of whether they formed part of the bankruptcy estate, but whether those custodial accounts ought to be listed as on the schedules? Remind me, what is the authority for that notion?
What this court has said that is that on a Schedule B, a person is meant to list all personal property of any kind. And that may be regardless of the fact that that person is holding that property for somebody else. So, for example, if Mr. Mays had legal title to these accounts, as it appears he did, then he is meant to list this on the bankruptcy schedules. I mean, this court has said again and again, the point of the bankruptcy process is to be honest and forthright in order to demonstrate that that person is actually eligible for bankruptcy protections. And Mr. Mays, by omitting that from his Schedule B and by omitting his daughter from Schedule D, I believe, which lists the potential debtors, he has not been honest with the bankruptcy process. He has not listed his biggest unsecured creditor, and he has not listed the property he could have used to pay down the debt he clearly owed to his daughter. And that is a fact which is simply not in dispute before this court. I mean, that is something to which he admitted under oath in his factual resume.
Isn't that the real dishonest statement? That he didn't list her as an unsecured creditor when he had borrowed money for the house against her, that he didn't list that is really the problem, not that he didn't list the account.
I think in terms of as an ordinal matter, which one is more egregious? I agree, Your Honor. But
you just need one.
What's that?
You just need one.
I agree. Statement. I agree. And that is certain. And that is certainly one.
We have to be careful because the most crucial thing in a bankruptcy case is to list all the assets that could arguably be in play and let the creditors and the judge decide who's got them, who really has title to them, who they belong to. You have to err when you read all this stuff. You've got to err on the side of disclosure and leave it up to the creditors and the judge to decide, okay, who gets it. So.
I agree 100%, Judge King. I think there has been a great deal of focus, I think mistakenly, on what will ultimately be part of the estate to the exclusion of what the operative question is here, which is what should be in the bankruptcy schedules. And
well, I'm just wondering if you have an obligation, if I'm a regular person off the street, do I have to disclose a custodial account on my bankruptcy schedule?
I believe so.
I don't know the answer to that still today. So,
to the extent that that is a question on which this case turns, and I believe it is, I've certainly searched. I have not found a clear or obvious answer to that question. And I think to the extent that's the case, that is fatal to Mr. Mays's claim on plain error review. But at the very least, had these accounts been listed, as I believe he was obligated to do so, it would have put the world on notice. It would have put the court on notice. It would have put the child's mother on notice. And as a result, his admissions in the factual resume that he knowingly and fraudulently omitted this material information remains a crime under 152 section 3.
And just so you know, and I think y'all probably have figured it out, Judge Willett is frozen, and that's why he's asking questions, but it looks like he's not moving. And so, but his video is frozen, but he's certainly very much participating in the argument, and you've had questions from him. So what's happening.
Understood, Judge. I'd like to briefly address section one, or rather prong three of the plain error. I realize it is a bit of a counterintuitive argument to make that somebody has not established that, but for these purported clear, obvious error, which of course we do not believe he demonstrated, that he would not have pled guilty. But all he argues in his brief is in a conclusory fashion that he would not have done so. And I can represent to the court that if this were to be remanded, he'd be facing not a 5-year cap of liability, but a 20-year cap of liability potentially, which I think ought to go into the court's consideration when it comes to the prong four argument as well. I think Mr.
Why would that go into our consideration? That's between him and his lawyer. We have lots of people who say what they want to roll the dice. That's up to them.
I agree.
It doesn't offend the integrity of the court for people to make choices about their own criminal jeopardy.
Fair enough. But at least when it comes to prong three, then, Your Honor, his claim that he wants to do things differently, I think, is not reasonably informed by the fact that a 20-year sentence could be, or maximum sentence at least, could be facing him. And that is particularly important in this case, where the district court quite clearly viewed his conduct as being particularly egregious.
Could you discuss the restitution issue?
I'd be happy to, Your Honor, because I think this is another place where Mr. Mays has misunderstood in all forms how this does work and how it's meant to work. I'd like to initially just start out by saying, under USC section 3663A, two parties may agree to restitution that falls outside of the offense of conviction, and the district court is then going to order it. So it absolutely may occur here, although even if that weren't the case, I believe that the offense here, when taken with the relevant conduct, is broad enough to permit restitution to have been separately ordered. But that is sort of a moot point, given that the parties agreed that restitution was appropriate and there's a statutory basis.
That solves my Sharma problem.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I mean, it's a statutory fix for that. The parties agreed to it, and it's completely appropriate and normal. But in terms of how the restitution works, I think it's worth a very brief discussion of how restitution works normally. A district court doesn't retain jurisdiction, as it were, over the restitution question. What it does at the sentencing hearing and then in the judgment is that it sets a sum certain of money that the defendant owes to the victim or victims. And then going forward, the government either applies seized property that's been liquidated to reduce that balance, or the defendant also pays into that number to reduce the balance. The district court doesn't need to retain jurisdiction because all it does is sets the total amount of damages or losses or restitution that needs to be paid. And then they pay that number down. It goes to the court clerk's office, and then it's dispersed to the victims. So the fact that the amount of restitution didn't go down before the judgment has no bearing on whether or not that restitution award is still viable, and it very much is. In this case, the government gave itself the option. It certainly did not obligate itself to do so, but it gave itself the option to sell that property prior to judgment. Even though that didn't happen, the government is still going to sell that property, reduce that amount to a sum certain, and apply that number and apply that money to the restitution figure by submitting it to the court clerk's office, so it'll be dispersed to the victim. The district court simply doesn't have to retain, nor does it retain, jurisdiction over these restitution questions, because all it needs to do is set the total amount of damages that the defendant has caused the victim or victims, as the court did here, and then that number will go down in the future. Mr. Mays has not established on plain error review or otherwise that this process was somehow improper or against any clear, obvious Fifth Circuit or other law.
Do you have anything further for us?
If the court has no further questions, I'm happy to cede the balance of my time.
No, I'm not hearing any questions, okay. Thank you. Mr. Kuchera? You're on mute.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay, I'm sorry about that. Mr. Magliolo appears to have created a duty to disclose that doesn't appear to me anywhere in the bankruptcy statute. He says there's a broader group of assets out there somewhere that a bankrupt or attempted bankrupt person needs to list that don't appear in the statute. I don't know how you can hold anybody accountable for that kind of a standard. Nobody could know that. I guess it depends on the individual conscience. And since the government assumes that Mr. Mays is sort of a bad guy anyway, he should have known better and should have put it there. But the bankruptcy code makes it pretty clear that if he has no, and Mr. Magliolo suggests that Mr. Mays has some sort of legal title over that, he doesn't. At least if my authorities that I quoted are accurate, that property is indefeasibly vested in the minor. He has no legal or equitable title in that money. He had the authority to misuse it, but that doesn't give him legal or equitable title. I just don't see how a person could be held accountable for not listing something based on, well, they sort of should have known better because it's up to the, you know, it's up to the bankruptcy judge or the authorities to determine. We'll sift it out. You just put everything down there. I don't see how that's a standard that this court can apply or that, you know, any American citizen ought to be held to. If I heard Mr. Magliolo correctly, he said he agreed that the district court has no jurisdiction over the restitution issue and that it's simply left to the clerk and the government to honor this. Well, hopefully they will. But what if they don't? I mean, if the court has no jurisdiction over this, then contested matters can't ever come in front of the judge. I don't see how that's a workable. If the court has no jurisdiction, then the court can't enforce this plea agreement. And if the government hadn't taken care of all this pre-sentencing, then it's the court can't fix it if it doesn't, if it goes awry down the road. So that's a plea agreement that can't be fulfilled. I'm not suggesting that the government or any of the parties involved set out to create a situation where the plea agreement could not be consummated, but that's the net effect. And if that's the net effect, the plea bargain is it doesn't exist. It has no authority, in which case the court, in my opinion, is stuck with Sharma. And absent the plea agreement, there's no statutory authority to assess the restitution the way it's been assessed in this case.
But if there were some problem with the restitution, the counting of the restitution, there are remedies. Mandamus being certainly one, if the clerk's office is not applying the restitute. I mean, but that's a hypothetical because there's no evidence here that anyone's not applying the restitution appropriately yet.
Yet, but, well, you're right, not yet. But if it's a plea agreement that's unenforceable, and I don't think anybody is suggesting that the government has sold any of this stuff and turned the money over to anybody in the clerk's office. I certainly hadn't heard that from anybody.
Did your client make false statements on the statement of financial affairs?
I didn't understand the question.
Did your client make any false statements on the statement of financial affairs?
The only one I looked at is the one the government said constituted the factual basis. I didn't go through the entire bankruptcy filing with him to see if he had made any other misstatements or misstatements at all.
Should we consider whether your client made false statements on the statement of financial affairs?
I think you should only consider the factual basis proffered by the government. And, that's the government gets to pick the case. The government gets to pick the charges. The government gets to draft the plea agreement, draft the factual basis. This is the government's baby. They drafted this up. They should be held to it. I don't think, obviously, I'm not unbiased here, and I don't think the court should go looking for other ways to make this stand up by seeing if they could find other false statements in the bankruptcy pleadings if those weren't the ones picked by the government.
Thank you, Mr. Kachera. We have your argument. We've had this case is submitted. We note that you are a CJA appointed in this case, and you zealously represented your client as is the custom that you have in these cases. So thank you very much for your service. The case is submitted, and this court is adjourned for today. Thank you.